Welcome to the Subtle Cane Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Smith, broadcasting from the Aorta of America, beautiful festival city, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where we pump out reason and pierce through the propaganda. Here we go. Today is Sunday, February 25th, 2024. This is episode 64 of the Subtle Cane Podcast, interview with Ian Davis. If you're new to the Subtle Cane Podcast, thank you for gracing us with your virtual presence. If you're a returning listener, thank you for your continued support. It is much appreciated. Today we speak to author, journalist, blogger, and autodidactic researcher of the highest caliber, Mr. Ian Davis. Ian is a thoughtful, engaging writer who shares my value for sifting and winnowing through the evidence. Ian presents his arguments with the explicit desire to inspire curiosity and enter the arena of ideas. I believe you'll enjoy this thought-provoking and hope-invoking conversation. Let's get into it. Good afternoon, Mr. Ian Davis. Thank you for coming on the Subtle Cane Podcast. I sincerely appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much, Aaron. It's very kind of you to invite me.
Well, Ian, I've been following up on your work, and for a while now I've been following you and always been impressed with a few things about you. Specifically, though, something that resonates with me that I always talk about with the audience is your right on your About Me page, you say, "Any media outlet or commentator that asks you to trust them is suggesting that you abandon critical thinking and simply believe whatever they tell you, and that you will never ask that of people and ask them to arrive at their own conclusions." And I sincerely appreciate that about you and the humility that is evident in your approach to sifting and winnowing through the evidence. So I was curious if you would share with the audience a little bit about your background and what was the seminal moment when you decided to pursue your writing and research, and what most influenced you to focus on the subject matter that you focus on, mainly technocracy, I'd say, right?
Yeah. My background is in health and social care. I worked in health and social care, various different, both in public and private settings, in institutional and in the community. And I worked in that for about 30 years. One of the problems of working in that industry is the various periods of unemployment. And when I was made redundant again, I think, now I'm going to say that was 2011 or something like that, I think, or 2000, but maybe a bit later, 2012, I can't remember now. But by that time, I'd already been a union steward and a rep for a number of years in various different roles. And since a child, I've always been quite politically, just interested in politics, and that extended to geopolitics and so forth. And then when I was at the unions, I used to do a bit of writing for Union Magazine and the Union Trade Magazine, and I used to write a few articles and things like that. I started the blog, I'm going to say 2010-ish, I think. I started the blog, and it purely was simply to highlight what I thought was important evidence that people generally weren't talking about. And one of the things I noticed is that when I spoke to people about that evidence, they'd either never heard of it or didn't know what I was talking about. So I thought it was quite important to just put that out there if I could. And it was very much a hobby. Then when I was made redundant, I thought about the possibility of trying to do it on a more full-time basis. I retrained as a journalist. And so this is later. Yeah, this is 2016, 2015. So I must have been made redundant around then. I retrained as a journalist, did a vocational qualification, and started working on it as full time as possible. I was very fortunate. And I think the way that things work, and that this has become an increasingly difficult people to start getting the message out to others, or start trying to share their message, as you will know full well, working in this space yourself, is that it's getting increasingly difficult to share information. You know, there's a, certainly through the kind of main route, which is social media, generally through social media, there's so much, you know, I was fortunate, I suppose, in many respects, is that I was able to share information relatively freely in the early days. I mean, that's come to a grinding halt now. But in that time, that drew me to the attention of people like bigger outlets like UK Column and The Off Guardian, who started sharing my work, and that enabled me to garner a little bit more of an audience for the things that I write about. My reason for writing about the things I do, and you're quite right, I focus on technocracy quite a bit, and something I call the global public-private partnership, which is hoping to establish a global technocracy, I would suggest. You know, like most people, I suppose 9/11 made me question things, but not overtly. I wouldn't say that I was particularly questioning of official narratives beyond my broadly left-wing political views at the time. And then I think, when did I read it? I read Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard when I was probably in my mid-30s. So that's, you know, that's a good 20 years ago now, probably around the time of 9/11, actually. And what struck me about that was that, you know, if you read that, what struck me most clearly was that there really are individuals and groups of people on this planet who consider things like nation states to be little more than squares on a game board, and whole populations to be pawns, to be pushed around in that game, that geopolitical grand strategic game that they are playing. And I found that, you know, coming from the horse's mouth, as anyone that's read that particular book will know, I just found that very shocking, really, and truly startling. So that started me down the path of looking more at information about, you know, where true power lies, both, you know, in my own country, the United Kingdom, and abroad, and globally. And that, I think that over the years, that developed into, you know, and then reading people like Patrick Wood, that led me into writing on the subject matters that I currently write about.
That's quite a path. And I would say the idea of the redundancy, I can admire that there was a resilience within you that didn't just look at that as put up your hands in the air and say, whatever, I'll just limp along in life. And it seems that fueled your creativity and your ability to perceive things and recognize patterns and things like that I think is missing largely in a lot of the public right now. And that I think is concerning, that people, when they are confronted with the types of hardships that are, I would say, largely put upon us, when you're talking about the geopolitics or the economic environment that we're in, that resiliency is always impressive, and I think is missing quite a bit. So I respect that. A lot of the information that I've or interviews I've listened to you on, and work that you've written, one of the things that strikes me is this article you, I think, just recently released. I can't, it refuting the canard of the
Oh yeah.
sorry. The multi yeah. polarity versus unipolarity.
Yeah, no, the canard that I was refuting, and that was in a Substack article, where, you know, I tend to reserve Substack for being a bit more irreverent at times and a bit more freewheeling than I do on my blog. And my blog is very much kind of, you know, pretty deep research stuff, whereas I more freely express my opinion through my Substack. So one of the reasons that, you know, as one of the people that criticizes multipolarity, which, obviously, you know, for your listeners, perhaps, is the notion of a more fair system of global governance, a more multilateral system of global governance, where multilateralism obviously means shared decision making with more nation states involved. So on its surface, if you accept the notion of global governance, which I don't, I think it's an appalling idea. But if you do, then on its surface, that seems to be preferential to what we might call the international rules-based order, which stemmed from the unipolar world order, where the US was left as the only global superpower, really, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, you know, so you've got a Western-aligned, kind of NATO-aligned alliance of nation states. You've got the US, Canada, Australia, you know, the Five Eyes. You've got New Zealand. You've got the EU and European nation states, all kind of broadly aligned with this NATO coalition, US-led NATO coalition, who undoubtedly over the last few decades have been, you know, really striding around the world with impunity, causing all kinds of mayhem, invading countries, bombing countries. I mean, that started in the 90s, really, in Europe with the willful destruction of Yugoslavia, for which there was no reason other than geopolitical and geostrategic gain in terms of wanting to balkanize the region and break it up. Again, we were looking at energy infrastructure, probably very much underpinning that. Things like the Siam pipeline, you know, supplying oil and gas. These kind of things, you know, where global investors seek to capitalize on human suffering often. I mean, that's the bottom line. And very much that was being pushed by and undoubtedly by what people call the international rules-based order, which is no rules really at all. I mean, there aren't any rules. Might is right is about as far as it goes. Mm-hmm. The multipolar world order, therefore, on its face seems like a reasonable and hopeful, some feel, obviously, hopeful change for the better. That more nation states would be involved in decision making at the global governance level through the under the auspices of the United Nations, and this will somehow create a better world. If you look at the history of where that idea comes from, it comes largely from the people that many sort of researchers such as G. Edward Griffin and people like that and Anthony C. Sutton and those kind of people would point towards in terms of being these kind of oligarch influences that are underpinning global investment strategies that things like the international rules-based order was set up to serve. So they also envisaged, you can go back to the Rhodes-Milner group, they envisaged what they called a three-pole world or a three, I forgot what Quigley called it now, but a three-pole world or three different poles in the world, which would be, you know, the US bloc, the European bloc, and the kind of Soviet Eurasian bloc. Then there was, you know, later you've got people like the Rockefellers who published a thing called their Special Studies Report in the 19, it was called the Project for American Supremacy or the Project for American Foreign Policy. I can't remember the name of the actual publication, but it stemmed from their Special Studies Report in which they spoke about a regionalized world. So breaking it up into more manageable chunks instead of 193 nations. All vying for making decisions at a global governance level, you break it up into blocks, and each block sort of represents the nation states that are contained within it. They called that the regionalized world. We saw the same thing again in the World Economic Forum's 2020 COVID-19, the Great Reset publication, where Schwab and Malloray were talking about, you know, the managed breakdown of globalization, which, if you think about the kind of the economic ideas of people like Schumpeter, it's this idea of creative destruction, of breaking things apart to remodel it in a more beneficial way. So they're talking about the same idea of regionalization. And then we then get the emergence of the multipolar world order, which really kind of took, I suppose, public shape, took hold of the public imaginations, probably with the joint statement of President Putin and Xi Jinping about 3 weeks before Russia entered the conflict in Ukraine. Officially entered the conflict in Ukraine. And really what they were talking about there was this, trying to sell this idea of multipolarity. So the critics, and I am one of those critics, argue that what we are seeing is nothing new. This is not a reinvention of global governance. It is the natural evolution of global governance. If your intention is to establish what we might call global governance with teeth. So hitherto, you know, projects like the League of Nations and the United Nations have never really managed to overcome the internal difficulty of national sovereignty. So nation states making decisions in their own interest is not something that the United Nations has ever been able to overrule to any great extent. So now we see things like the World Health Organization obviously pushing forward with the international health regulation reforms and its proposed quote unquote pandemic treaty, which is an attempt to genuinely overrule national sovereignty on a global level. And I think it's not coincidental that those two things, that is emerging at the same time as we see the emergence of what people are calling the multipolar world order. Because the purpose of the multipolar world order is to make the UN appear to be a more multilateral organization, lend it further credibility, and thus enable it to genuinely act as a global decision maker. And that means setting policies in nation states. Now, to a great extent, the United Nations already does that, but it does it through policy agenda rather than actually stipulating what policies are. The move, the trajectory of where the multipolar world order is taking us is towards a situation where global governance will be set in firm policy, which is much closer to what we might call a global government.
Correct. Yeah. And in a technocratic approach at that, with all of the mechanisms put into place. When you were talking there, I was just thinking about the fact that the IMF and similar institutions, central banking institutions, as of late have been really focused on solving the interoperability problem with the CBDCs, and that sovereignty being an issue. So trying to figure out, well, how do we maintain these individual currencies while having this interoperability? And it seems that the foregone conclusion, though they pretend to lament it, is that we will have to eventually adopt a single currency in order to solve that problem, and in so make that a programmable currency. I like the metaphor you used, or the analogy you used, of the conflicts that we see in between these different quote unquote sovereign nations, depending on how you interpret that, as the boxers are still in the ring fighting each other. There's still boxing going on, but that doesn't mean that they're protesting the Federation of Boxing. So there's still an overarching financial financial structure and power structure that oversees these conflicts, and, you know, if to even drag it out further, making a lot of money on the books as well, as far as betting between them and manipulating outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at for Ukraine, for example, I mean, you know, it's now been openly admitted, isn't it, that most of the investment that went into Ukraine was being directly, you know, it was used to fuel the US armaments industry. Investors in that are the ultimate winners. So it's global investors that you know, trade and deal in stocks of these companies, these multinational companies, you know, companies like Raytheon. They're the winners. They win when there's a war like there is in, you know, like there has been in Ukraine, a conflict in Ukraine, well, a genuine war in Ukraine, you know, not so much in the Middle East, but that's more of a slaughter. But I mean, but there's a genuine war in Ukraine between opposing armies. Then it's globalist investors that are the only winners in that. They're the only people that win out of that situation. The public certainly don't. The people don't. The military doesn't. You know, the soldiers that fight and die in it certainly don't. And to a certain extent, you know, even political establishments succeed or fail by what happens in such conflicts. But the persistent and continual winners are the globalist investors, the people that we might call oligarchs, who convert that wealth, exorbitant wealth, that they've hoovered up, you know, often over generations, but often not. Often, you know, there's new money that comes into it. I mean, we might think of someone like Jeff Bezos or someone like that. Mm-hmm. They convert that wealth into influence and authority. And one of the vehicles they can do that through is the United Nations. I mean, the United Nations was set up as a public-private partnership. I think it was in 1998, Kofi Annan, who was then the General Secretary, spoke about what he called a quiet revolution that had taken place in the United Nations. And he said that the United Nations was no longer concerned just with the governments of the world, but also with the businesses of the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you see this amalgam between the political state and the corporate state, that's fascism. That's pretty much, you know, that's a root definition of the fascismo, as in the Italian concept of fascism. There is nothing beyond the state, because all commerce and all business activity and, you know, all supply and demand, all services, all public services, everything is encapsulated within one single unit, which is, you know, a partnership between the public and the private, which is the state. So yeah. That's very worrying. So, I mean, if we then think about how this is happening on a global level, which it currently is, we're seeing this come to fruition through, for example, we were talking about the World Health Organization earlier. Mm-hmm. Well, if we look at the power afforded to people, private investors, private oligarchs, people like Bill Gates that have got a controlling interest, financial controlling interest in the World Health Organization. So that is the conversion of wealth to direct political power, not on the national level, but on the global level in this example. Yeah. But it more commonly occurs at the national level, where we see this marriage between government policy and private capital. Government policy, you know, you can look at pretty much any government policy, and it invariably serves the interest of private capital. It doesn't serve the interests of us. If it does serve our interests, that's usually a coincidence rather than the purpose. most of these decisions are, and policy decisions that are enforced upon us, quite obviously serve the interest of private capital.
Yeah, I see one of the responses when people like yourself bring up the advantage of, let's say, the war in Ukraine for contractors, private partnerships with the government. I often hear in response to that a canard, I would imagine, is that you don't care about the people, or you're denying that there's real harm and suffering going on. And that's one of the things you also pointed out, was that you're not denying that real people are dying or there's actual struggle and hardship going on in the world. It's just pointing out the, I think, as you put it, compartmentalized hierarchical structure that's over and above that is benefiting from it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote that particular piece was about one of the responses that is often kind of thrown at people that are criticizing what we perceive to be global power structures, is that we are claiming that all governments are in it together. I mean, that's often thrown, oh, you're just saying there's all in it together, so therefore the war is fake, all conflicts are fake, you know, that nothing's real, it's all a show, and so on.
Yeah,
but the conflicts are real. I mean, the point is that the global governance system that everyone agrees on, right? There are certain pillars that we can, going back to the idea of technocracy.
Yeah,
there are technocratic pillars that we can identify that all nation states agree on. They're all pursuing some sort of digital monetary system, digital technology, central bank digital currency, or some sort of digitized tokenized coin that they'll sell to the public, which will be, as you rightly mentioned earlier, interoperable in one kind of global financial, new international monetary and financial system. Everyone agrees on that. Mm-hmm. And I mean everyone. I mean the US, Russia, China, they agree. There's no difference in this. Sustainable development goals. Everybody is pursuing sustainable development. Now, there are differences in how they're doing it. I mean, the UK government has set its net zero target for 2050. China set its for 2060. The US has, the US hasn't even firmly set a net zero target date yet. You know, so there are differences about how they're going to achieve sustainable development, but they're all on board with the idea. Think biosecurity. You know, the need for us all to have some sort of digital identity so that we can verify who we are for a variety of goods and accessing services, be it everything from the internet to banking, but also that will be tied to our vaccine status so that we can be deemed safe. You know, all countries are on board with that. There is no dissent. So these are the pillars, we could say, of global technocracy. These are the things that will be used to control populations through governments, through national governments, but they will use these things to control their own populations. And then if we think about that, how that would operate at a global governance level, which would be setting the rules for this system, then that converts into global governance controlling populations. But within that, there is clearly conflict. There is absolutely conflict. So what are we looking at? We're not looking at any challenge to the pillars of global technocracy. That is a single global system that everyone seems to accept. Every nation state accepts that. So why the conflict? Well, if we think of the analogy of, for example, a global corporation, the board of the global corporation are squabbling amongst themselves for advantage. But that doesn't, you know, they're quite happy to stab each other in the back if necessary to gain advantage within the corporation. Mm-hmm. But every single one of them is on board with the profitability and the further development and progress of the corporation, because it's through the corporation that all their boats float. So that's what we're looking at. We're looking at conflicts between nation states that are squabbling for advantage and position within one global governance system that they all agree on.
Short break here. The Subtle Cane podcast operates on a modified value-for-value system. You'll hear no ads on this show, and that's because I will not be beholden to the interests of anyone but you, my faithful producers. Instead of returning value to me, I want you to support the featured need. And I've been thinking about this, and I don't really care for the sound of featured need. Seems a little too much like, I don't know, alms for the poor to me. So instead, I'm going to start referring to it as the Subtle Cane Spotlight. This episode, the Subtle Cane Spotlight is fixed on one Richard D. Hall at the request of our guest, Ian Davis. As always, I implore you to make your own decision about who or what to support. The Subtle Cane Spotlight is a way to bring people and their needs to your attention. It's up to you to decide what to do with that information. Please consider returning any value that I may have provided you with my efforts here to Mr. Richard D. Hall. We have to be personally invested in the world within which we have agency. Let's get back to it.
Yeah, even more of a microcosm of that I was thinking about as you were speaking there. When you look at the mechanisms that are being put into place, the stated goals, there's such a paternalism to that. And it just made me think of even within a family, the way each child is such a unique individual, a unique person. And there's always these fights that happen between the children, and the parent goes in and, let's say, with the oldest child, they respond only to a harsh screaming. I mean, you got to scream at them to get them to listen. Maybe you have a more timid child that you can be real gentle with, and you get the same response, and then you have, you know, any variation of that. And when you have these overarching principles and mechanisms in place, these global public-private partnerships, there are going to have to be very unique, different approaches to each area based on their culture, about how they see the world. Like the Eastern cultures appear to me, now I don't know, but appear to me much more compliant to that paternalistic instinct, or much more compliant. It's a community mindset, you know, the needs of the many over the needs of the few. Whereas in the Western society, particularly in the United States, we need to at least have the illusion that we're in charge of the decisions that are made.
Yeah, I mean, so if you look at, for example, Chinese culture that's based upon concepts like Ditong. So Ditong is, the idea of following the Great Way. So following the path, the Great Way is the path towards a society of Ditong, where everybody shares everything equally. There's no ownership of anything. All resources are freely available to everybody. You know, it's a kind of utopian ideal of, you know, what we might probably in the West might consider to be a kind of more kind of socialist. It's not socialism, but that kind of idea of a shared future between all people. There's no particular private property, or individualism isn't celebrated to any extent. And it's very difficult for us sometimes to apply Western mores when we're trying to analyze places like China. You know, they've got no ontological tradition in China. They don't, you know, we look at an object and we try to describe what it is, right? So we try to, what's it made of? What, you know, how does it work? What is it? What can we describe it as? In China, it's a totally different mindset. What they see something and think, well, what does it imply? What does it mean? How does that affect my path? You know, what does it do in terms of me, how do I maneuver in light of this thing rather than what is this thing? Now, that's a very, very different mindset. So if we, you know, look at things like the rollout of central bank digital currency, if we look at how they've rolled that out or tried to roll that out in a country like Nigeria, where basically the government took a really authoritarian top down, right, we're getting rid of cash, and you're going to use CBDC. Mm-hmm. Now, that confrontational approach backfired very badly in Nigeria because the Nigerian people resisted that very strongly. So, but the Bank for International Settlement were involved in the development of that Nigerian CBDC, which is called the eNaira, were involved in that from day one. And it was really, it was work between the Nigerian Central Bank and the Bank for International Settlement, which is the central bank of central banks, that enabled the eNaira to be developed so quickly. They really focused on it to try and get it rolled out. So they were, you know, for although unpleasant, and this has got a rather, I mean, when I looked at this, I thought this had a rather unpleasant whiff of neo-colonialism about it as well. But they just thought, right, well, we'll just try it on the Nigerian population, which is 225 million people, by the way.
Yeah.
They just stamped it on them to see what would happen. And the reaction was visceral. So when it comes to rolling it out in places like the UK or the US, so the UK is rolling out its digital pound. And the Bank of England went out of its way to say, don't worry, we're not getting rid of cash. We'll never get rid of cash. This is simply about financial stability and international cross-border payments. You know, we're only looking at it theoretically. Meanwhile, other people in the Bank of England are speaking at places like Davos and saying that they're planning to pay everybody in it. You know, so they're not, on the one hand, they're telling the British public that it don't worry, there's nothing to worry about, it's not going to replace cash. And in other places around the world, the same bank or officials from the same bank are saying that's how you are going to get your salary.
Yeah, so, it smacks of 2 weeks to flatten the curve.
Yeah, exactly. But then if we look at somewhere like the US, where there are legal moves from states in the US to stop CBDC. Mm-hmm. And there is already, I would, you know, there seems to be a reasonable level of or a greater awareness of what CBDC portends in the US than many other countries. You know, obviously not Nigeria, who really understand what it means. But yeah. but certainly, you know, in the kind of Western world, the US, I mean, there's been, you know, states ruling it, you know, that they're not going to accept it. So there's resistance. So what are they doing in the US? They're doing a bait and switch in the US. So the digital coin, these tokenized digital coins, these stable coins and variations of stable coins. If you look at what they're planning to do, for example, JP Morgan, for example, JP Morgan Chase & Co., for example, they've issued a coin which they're calling a deposit token. So this deposit token is just going to be issued by commercial, things like that are just going to be issued by commercial banks. So they'll say, you know, it's not CBDC really, you know, it isn't really CBDC, it's just another form of stable coin or cryptocurrency, won't be a crypto, but stable coin. Now, it's going to be programmable. Right, which is the big threat of central bank digital currency. So instead of it being programmed by Jerome Powell, it's going to be programmed by Jamie Dimon. I don't think that's a win-win situation for anybody, right? So and all these people are in the global public-private partnership together. It doesn't matter whether JP Morgan or Deutsche Bank or your central bank programs the money. And what they're going to do as well is these coins although they'll be issued by the central, by the commercial banks in countries like the US, lulling the public into believing they're not central bank digital currency, I think they will settle internationally in central bank digital currency. So clearance is going to be done in CBDC, and that's why the Bank for International Settlements, as you mentioned earlier, have been obsessed with this idea of interoperability for cross-border payments. Because what they want to do is create a single international monetary and financial system digital infrastructure, which means that if I trade oil in the yen, say, you know, Saudi oil futures in the yen, that will be instantly tradable in New York in the dollar.
Sure.
Without there being any kind, you know, there'll be an exchange mechanism, but that will be calculated by AI instantaneously, and payments will be able. So, you know, if I'm a US investor and I want to get into that market in Saudi Arabia, and they're using the yen, then I can just simply do that straight away from the US without any kind of delay or cross-border payment delays or anything like that. No clearing, none of that. Taking that out of the loop, and I can just, it doesn't matter what current, you know, effectively it doesn't matter what currency I'm using. So what that will do globally, I think, I mean, the more I look at it, the more I think what we're moving to, and I wrote about something that Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England and the Central Bank of Canada, spoke about something called a synthetic hegemonic currency. Now, it's quite interesting because he was talking in 2019 and he said that the reason that the world needed this was to move towards a multipolar world order. So this is a G7 banker talking about this in 2019. He's not a banker anymore. Now he's the UN's climate envoy for finance, you know, and, you know, I mean, Mark Carney's just everywhere. But I mean, but the point is, the synthetic hegemonic currency, really, the idea is that it would be a network of interoperable currencies. It wouldn't just be one single CBDC or one single currency, but it would be an interoperable network. So interoperability means that the whole thing functions as one whole.
Yeah.
So what coin we use, whatever coin we use, say it's JP Morgan's deposit token, although you're buying and selling food or goods or services, you're buying a haircut with your JP Morgan token, that will instantaneously settle globally in one single, what they're calling the universal ledger. Sure. Right. So that the Bank of International Settlements is going to operate, or is planning to operate, the universal ledger, which, regardless of what currency you're using, if interoperability works as they hope it will give someone like the Bank of International Settlements oversight over all transactions on Earth.
Right.
So commercial banks will access these ledgers through contractual agreements. Right. So they'll be given licenses to access national ledgers, and each national ledger will feed into the international ledger, the universal ledger. So this is a pretty totalitarian economic control system that they're trying to construct. And that's what we all need to resist.
Yeah. Well, so a universal ledger, which would mean that you had to have a universal means of regulation, which would mean that, and money is power. And so that would mean, regardless of whatever lipstick they put on the pig, it's still going to be a functional loss of actual sovereignty, regardless. We can call it the whatever, we could even call it the Patriot CBDC over here, and people would feel good about it. But functionally, we would be losing all sense of sovereignty in that our economic interactions would be regulated outside of the United States, just as one example.
Yeah.
That's sovereignty gone, regardless. Yeah. The programmability has always been just terrifying to me in the sense that, well, I think one of the things in the West, particularly in in the Americas, that brought a light to that was that Canadian trucker situation where they shut people's money off for supporting the Canadian trucker demonstrations. And so I don't know if anything, if it succeeded in bringing awareness to the danger of programmability of our money like that. I think that that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that... Sorry, carry on. Sorry, mate.
No, go ahead. Thank you.
I mean, I think the thing that struck me about the Canadian protest was obviously... So firstly, what are you seeing? You're seeing a marriage, a partnership between the state and private financial institutions. So the state decrees that some, or, you know, we are led to believe that the state decrees that something must happen, and the financial institutions comply instantly by blocking, for example, protesters' access to bank accounts or for the funds that they're using for the protest. But the thing that really struck me about that what something else that they did was stop the fundraising of ordinary Canadians.
Yeah.
So ordinary Canadians that wanted to contribute to things like GoFundMe pages that you know, just to support what something that they believed in, perhaps, you know, the truckers process, they were stopped from being able to do that. They literally couldn't make that donation because those GoFundMe pages and everything was shut down, right? So they had no way of supporting the truckers protest financially. Now, in a programmable digital currency world, that ability to, through things called smart contracts that will shut off or open up pathways for using your money, limitless. It could be done on an individual basis, it could be done on a national basis. So for example, you know, people often talk about the let's take that, the Canadian truckers situation. The state wouldn't need to pass any kind of policy announcement or legislation to enable that the shutdown, or even use legislation as it did in Canada to take new legislation, you know, that had only been written a couple of years earlier, coincidentally, but to use legislation to shut down things like GoFundMe pages. They wouldn't need to do that because your money itself is programmable. So you would go to the GoFundMe page and, you know, donate your Bank of Canada digital coin to the GoFundMe page, and the transaction itself wouldn't work, right? You couldn't physically make that transaction. But more to the point, that would be done instantaneously in real time. That this is what this world, this financial and monetary system world they're trying to construct portends. That level of control. So feasibly, you don't even need policy. You don't need legislation. You can literally, I mean, when we talk about things, something that we talk about in regard to Agenda 2030 and 21, the 15-minute city, this idea that you can't go, you know, that everything, you know, the way it's sold is that it'd be this some kind of beautiful place where everything's within a 15-minute bike ride or walk or whatever. But in reality, in a digital world, you wouldn't need walls to pen people in.
Right.
You would just disable their money more than a 15-minute radius from their house.
Yeah.
So you see, they can't go anywhere else because their money won't work. So you don't even need to construct physical barriers. You can just make it impossible for people to operate outside of a 15-minute radius from their house. That is what digital programmable money portends. That's where we're heading. And we're heading there quickly. We're really heading there at a rate of knots. So, you know, I think people really need to resist this stuff. And it's good to see that they are resisting it in places like the US and in Nigeria and other places around the world. And indeed in places like China, which you know, despite its, perhaps a cultural willingness to accept governmental edicts that are more ready willingness to accept that.
Sure.
The uptake of CBDC in China has been nothing special. Well, I mean, it's been more successful really with the kind of corporate investors and people like that than it is with the public. The Chinese public aren't enthusiastic about it. Far from it. So I think everybody, when they're confronted with it, with what it is and this kind of digital money, everyone is kind of naturally, hang on a minute, is naturally suspicious about it, because unlike cash, you don't have any control over it. I mean, another way of looking at it is, if this proceeds as envisaged and as planned by people like the Bank for International Settlements, human beings will never have their own money ever again. You won't have your own money. It won't be your money. It will belong to, I mean, it, technically speaking, that's already the case. But I mean, but you won't have purchasing power. You won't have control over your own economic future.
And so that seems like a good place to switch up a little bit, because we've discussed how much power money and control of economics has. There's also the problem of information is power and information being controlled. And obviously we could go on for quite a while on that, but specifically I wanted to, at your request, focus on one instance where information is being suppressed and someone is being punished for their just desire to find truth and share observable facts. And that would be Mr. Richard D. Hall. You wrote the article Travesty of Justice about that recently. Do you want to give us some more background on this gentleman?
Yeah, Richard D. Hall is an independent investigative journalist and researcher and independent filmmaker, documentary filmmaker in the UK. And he has done a lot of work on the Manchester Arena bombing that occurred in May 2017, where it was said that 22 people were killed. It was an Islamist terrorist who was the alleged culprit, a guy called Salman Abedi, or he was the culprit, a guy called Salman Abedi. And that this caused, you know, this was obviously a massive terror attack on UK soil. Richard D. Hall has investigated that terror attack more thoroughly than any other journalist in the UK and in the world. He is scrupulously and diligently reported on and investigated as much evidence as he possibly could related to that terror attack. He has, in my view, adequately demonstrated that what we are told about Manchester certainly isn't true, and the high likelihood that it was some sort of false flag event.
Mm.
Now, for that, he is currently facing prosecution in the High Court of Justice in the UK in a civil action that was brought against him by two of the claimants, who are two of the purported victims of the Manchester Arena attack. But more than that, so he's facing this. So this could see him bankrupted and could see the removal of all of his work and all of his years of research from the internet, book burning, in other words, physically stopping him. He's written a book. He's written a fantastically researched book called Manchester, The Night of the Bang, in which he gives all this evidence, where he reports much of this evidence to the public. Subsequent to that, he's uncovered a tremendous amount of evidence that wasn't discussed in the ultimate public inquiry, the Saunders inquiry into the bombing. And not only is he being attacked in the courts, it seems pretty evident. And again, he's presented the evidence which shows that the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, were highly likely to have been instrumental in that prosecution, whether they encouraged the claimants to make the claim or supported them in some way, who knows. The BBC told Hall about the prosecution. He didn't hear it from the courts or from the claimant's legal team. He heard it from the BBC. They told him. You know, the BBC have shut down his market stall. He's got a small market stall in near where he lives. They shut that down. They got the local council to shut down. They've had his YouTube videos. It was the BBC, evidently, that contacted YouTube to get his videos removed. The BBC have written, and one person in particular, a woman called Mariana Spring, who is supposedly the world's first, or the BBC's first, official disinformation and social media correspondent. They hounded Hall. They approached Hall on several occasions, asking him if he wanted to do an interview. He said no, but they door stopped him anyway. They then accused Hall of doing the same thing to people that he was investigating with regard to the Manchester Arena bombing, which he never did. You know, then you've got the entire British media establishment publishing quite disgusting character assassinations of this guy. You know, saying that he's Britain's sickest man was one headline. That he is a troll. You know, he's not even human. He's a troll. They rounded on the entire British establishment has rounded on him, and it's to shut down his evidence. Now, he went to court. The claimants applied to the court to have all of his evidence struck out. So there is no opportunity for him to mount any kind of meaningful defense or present his evidence to the court. And the judge ruled in their favor. So he can't even defend himself properly. So this is what is happening to this guy. But to his credit, he just carries on. He carries on fighting. So hopefully there'll be some links in the show notes, which I urge everybody to look at his work. And also, he's got a fundraiser, which, because he's intending to appeal this. Now, this is one guy standing up. Literally standing up to the entire British establishment on his own.
One of the things that really struck me, and I hope I don't get this wrong, but what was used to strike his defense from the record was it actually said, because it was unlikely to be successful, so let's just not hear it at all. Is that the general gist of?
Yeah, they were applying for something called a summary judgment, right? So a summary judgment, I mean, which is a legitimate thing to do in a case, is where you argue that the claimants argue that the defendant's evidence is so outrageous and so outlandish, preposterous, fanciful, which are words that the judge used in their summation. That it's just ridiculous. It stands no reasonable prospect of success because it's preposterous. Now, you know, that is, you know, perhaps plausible if you were claiming that the Queen was a lizard or something like that. I mean, that's reasonable in those circumstances. But he's not. He's shown evidence which is perfectly admissible in a British court, documentary evidence, video footage, you know, audio recordings of police recordings of what they were discussing on the night, documentary evidence, physical evidence. You know, he's not making up some sort of nutty story and trying to sell it in the courts.
Right.
See, he is presenting solid evidence which casts significant doubt and question on the claimant's claim. Now, so the court has just ruled that inadmissible in its entirety.
Yeah.
Just said, no, you can't present it. Now, the point is, and he's quite right, that in a civil action like this, the judge doesn't have to prove anything beyond all reasonable doubt. The judge only has to decide on the balance of probabilities. So the judge has accepted on the balance of probability that the claimant's claim is substantiated at this stage. The trial hasn't finished yet, but the claimant's claim is substantiated.
Yeah.
Now, Hall has shown that on the balance of probability, given all the evidence he can present, the claimant's claim is not substantiated. The claimants can't demonstrate that their claim is well-founded. That's his argument. But that doesn't matter because the court have struck a whole lot of it out.
And I think you rightly point to the fact that this is, even if somebody isn't particularly or specifically familiar with Mr. Hall's work, as a journalist, as just someone who's actually seeking truth and wants to know what is rather than what they're being told, this should alarm everybody. And these are the kind of people that we do need to get behind, because if it can happen to him, it's just setting more and more precedent and making it normalized.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's a threat to journalism because basically what it means is if there's another similar situation where a journalist is strongly questioning an official government narrative, potentially all the government needs to do is present someone who has been, you know, harmed in some way, whether that means that their mental health has been harmed because they feel so mortally offended by the mere accusation that they're not telling the truth. That this sets a legal precedent, which means that anyone that questions an official state narrative, especially journalists, could face bankruptcy, and you know the as a result. So you know, if you dare question the official narrative, we will, you know, not only will we not allow you to present your evidence to the court, we'll bankrupt you.
Yeah.
You know, so this is incredibly dangerous. And one of the important things that Richard D. Hall's pointed out is that there was a survey carried out not long ago, you know, I think it was a few years ago after the Manchester Arena bombing, where something like 28% of the UK adult population questioned it. And of that, one in seven, around 14%, didn't believe that people were actually died or were injured at the arena. They didn't believe it. So that's 7 million, that's equivalent to 7 million British citizens who essentially agree with Hall. Now, potentially, if any of them, because we've also got things like the online harms legislation being passed, which has already passed and is now being applied in Europe. We've got the Digital Services Act in the US. You're now talking about a US Online Harms Act. Mm-hmm. You know, potentially that means that if one of those 7 million people in the UK published, and they're calling it publishing, published, for example, Richard D. Hall's work, if they publish that, they too could be subject to these restrictions and these laws. They might find themselves in court facing bankruptcy as a result. Not just journalists, citizens. So we really, really need to support him in appealing this and hopefully winning the case, because if he loses, it's not going to be good for anyone.
Well, it seems like the UK, or one UK instance of something very similar that happened to Alex Jones not long ago, hear
yeah.
A financial attack based on things that he said. I'll be honest at this point, you know, this is my little contribution to the effort, this podcast, and, you know, my unintentionally exclusive audience. I find that I wake up some days and I wonder if I'm going to find myself in a situation where I'm redundant because of the information I share and I'm willing to talk to, and the people I'm willing to talk to someday in the near future, where just the conversation that we're having could reflect, you know, like cause me serious damage in my personal life. But, you know, I choose not to live in a way that is enough to, I don't want that fear, or I don't want fear to dissuade me from pursuing truth. And I respect that so much when I see that as well. And I see that in your work, Mr. Davis. You are a very honest guy. I mean, I really suggest people go to iandavis.com and follow you on Substack and support your work. I will have links in the show notes to your various sites. I will have links as well to Mr. Richard D. Hall's plight as the featured need for this episode. Is there anything that you would like to share, or any last thoughts, or you want to share what's on your plate now before we end up?
Yeah, sure. I'll just to point out that it's Ian Davis. You'll see the link in the show notes, but it's my name spelled IAIN Davis.com, which is not the usual, well, not the most common spelling of Ian. Yeah, I mean, what I would just like to say is that when we talk about this stuff, you're talking about the kind of things like, you know, global financial authority and economic power, you know, usurping the sovereignty of nation states. And then we think about how we are going to resist that. It all sounds very black pill, doesn't it? It all sounds absolutely hopeless. But one thing I would encourage people to take a lot of encouragement from, so much of what they do, and we're seeing that currently in Richard D. Hall's case, is about controlling us. It's about controlling our, in this case, access to information. So the question is, why? Why do they spend so much time and effort and money trying to control us? Well, the point, the obvious answer and the clear answer is that because they are scared of us, they're frightened of us. Because in reality, we have all the power. They have none. Their entire globalist structures are a facade. They're based upon our belief in their authority. So we allow them to tell us what to do. Now, the moment that we in significant numbers stop doing that and ignore them and no longer allow them to tell us what to do, it is over. It's finished. They've lost because they cannot control 8 billion people. The only way they can do it is through trickery, propaganda, coercion, and force. And if it comes down to force, if push, you know, sadly and regrettably, and let's hope it never does, but if push does come to shove, they cannot defeat 7.8 billion people. They lose. They always lose. So their whole game is a charade. And once we understand that, they have no power. They have no authority. We have it all. And then we can start, you know, the best solution that we can do, and we only need to take individual responsibility for ourselves and to be as independent as possible and work collectively together in our local communities to provide for ourselves, our families, and the people that we care about. If we start doing that on a global scale, there's nothing they can do about it. Nothing they can do about it. So that's, I think, that's my message, really, is we've got every reason to be hopeful, but it does require significant numbers of us to be aware of what's going on.
And a personal investment, not just a passive. You have to be engaged in your own. And I love that. And I think the idea of acting within the world within which you have agency, actual agency, and within which you can act is so important. And I thank you for that. I want to thank you again for your time, Mr. Ian Davis. And I really appreciated you coming on. And I hope very much that you will be willing to come back and discuss things again with us.
That's my pleasure, Aaron. Thank you very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it, mate.
All right. Appreciate you.
And that's what I love about this work. You get to meet such passionate, intelligent people who are taking a stand for what they believe in. Ian not only has a firm grip on the subject matter he writes about, he's also very kind and personable. He chooses to see the hope amidst the maelstrom of competing narratives and agendas and reminds us that we have a choice, that the proverbial fat lady hasn't yet taken the stage. Our ability to avoid the technocrats' ambitions hinges on our ability to recognize them for what they are in the first place. Take courage, my friends. Courage is not the lack of fear, it is the ability to move forward despite it. And support journalists like Ian Davis and Richard D. Hall. Remember that information is power. In light of that, in our conversation, it only makes sense to end with these words from Orwell's 1984. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. For all you listening, you are valued, you are loved, and you are worthy. God bless, and good night.
There's no turning back once the fire's lit, let the embers glow and be done with it. I'm startled by my lack of fear as a